So anyway, I want you to remember that as we look back. Look at chapter 6. And I want to comment just a tad more on prayer and then talk a little bit about fasting, because Lisa wanted me to say a word about that. Remember that what the Lord is doing here is he's talking about our works of righteousness, and he wants to be sure that they're driven by the right motive. And so he's working these three examples: giving and prayer and fasting. And what has been the contrast there? We shouldn't be concerned with what in our giving and fasting and prayer. Yeah. We shouldn't be doing this so people will see and be impressed with us. That's the wrong motive, right? And the interesting thing here is, on the outside, it may look how? Yeah, these are works of righteousness. It may look like when I'm giving. I mean, how do you think Ananias and Sapphira looked when they were giving all this money in Acts 5? And how'd God feel about that? It was bad. People died, right? It was a pretty big deal. So it's that same idea that we've been working all along since chapter 5 and verse 20. And so the same thing he says about prayer. Don't do it to be a spectacle. That needs to be between you and God. That needs to be your motive. But there is another piece to that. If you look at chapter 6 and verse 6, he adds this. No, I'm sorry, verse 7. And when you are praying, do not use meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do, for they suppose they will be heard for their many words. So do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask. Is this one different? Is the concern here with how it looks on the outside? Or what men will think? Maybe that's a better question. Is the concern here with what men will think? This seems to me to be about God. And for some reason they think, if I just say a bunch, God will be impressed with me. And what's his answer to that, by the way? You don't need to impress God with your many words. In fact, he knows what you need. Which, by the way, raises an interesting question. Why do we pray then if God already knows what I need? Why do I do it? Yeah. So maybe part of the lesson here that's really important is to recognize prayer isn't just about delivering information to God that he doesn't have, right? There's more to it. There's a relational piece to all of that. I'm just curious as to why this sort of breaks the pattern, mainly because I'm obsessed with structure. Everything is supposed to fit. And then someone pointed out to me, but you don't talk that way. Do you ever go on a tangent when you're talking? Like you're talking about this and all of a sudden you're over here and then you're over here. Sometimes with Jeff, I need a schematic because we start here and it's like, you know what? There were like four things back here that originally I wanted you to talk to you about. So we get off the subject. And I wonder if the Lord is just adding this additional thought as he talks about prayer. I guess we need to leave him room to do that, huh? It also may be that I just don't see how that works with the broader context. But there you go. You can think about those two things. Anyone want to comment on about that? Yes. Yes.
God wants us to have.
Yes. In fact, I think that sometimes, especially in our culture in this day and age, why we struggle to pray. Because think about this. I was thinking about this weekend listening to Ben Hall talk to the guys. I wonder if guys struggle with prayer because we do not think of it as manly when you see a guy humbled, bowed before someone else, right? That's not how we perceive manhood. And that's how we are before God. Think about that. I wonder if that's probably part of our struggle. Yeah.
I do think it relates to the...
Oh, please take a shot at it.
Well,
you can fix it for us.
Now, wait a minute. No, I just think that, sometimes... Now, these may have been private prayers. It's not really clear whether this is public prayers or private prayers. It sort of seems like it's public.
Well, they were doing it in public.
So they're saying a lot of words, and they're saying... They're using their big words, their fancy words, and that's what he's talking... You sound... But you're just babbling. You're just, you may sound good, but you're just... It's all meaningless. So again... You've got to take it a step further than that. It's got to be really... from the heart. And I think, you know, we can fall into that with our prayers. We have certain words we like to use that make us sound holier.
I wondered about this too. I'm with you on that. That another mistake you could make is to say a whole bunch or to say it in a way thinking others will be impressed with how much you can say, right? We had an elder back where I started preaching in Huntsville that clearly thought that God was impressed with length because his prayers were sometimes longer than my sermons. But or I think even maybe a greater temptation in our day and time for those who lead public prayers is for them to be worded in a certain way. I got to tell you, one of the most authentic prayer moments I ever had, we had a new convert up, and he was leading, I think, his first public prayer. And he's going along. Can y'all tell when someone's struggling? I mean, he was struggling. And he's like, Will Hester, you know him. Carla was in the crowd. Well, Will Hester says, God, just help me get through this prayer. I thought that's so real, isn't it, right? Because that's what he needed right at that moment. He needed to get through that. My struggle with that, though, is this appears to be something with God. Who's hearing? Okay. Others do hear. Others do hear.
The contrast with all of it is God is the one who speaks, right?
He needs
to. One of these things, he's saying, you know, you think you're giving, but God saw.
Right.
He knows what you really get. And it's the same thing with the prayer. You think you're saying all these fancy words, and you think, but God hears.
That's right.
I think the contrast is the same.
So he follows with a sample of how to pray. Would anyone like to comment on what's traditionally called the Lord's Prayer? Oh, I'm sorry. You were just waving at me.
I know. Yep.
It's okay. Anyone have a thought about that?
I'll give you a comment, though.
You want to jump in?
I did always think it was interesting in verse 7. He talks about, do not use meaningless, repetitive stuff. And then verse 9, we just continuously repeat.
It is interesting that in the context where the repetitions are addressed, that someone would grab the prayer and use it sometimes for some exactly that way. Any other? Yes?
Just since we're talking about it, what I talked with you about a minute ago, the last sentence is, for thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever, amen. And that's in King James. It's not in ASV. It's not in ESV.
Yeah, and what I told you before class, it hasn't changed since then.
I
haven't read the King James in so many years that I was unaware that that wasn't in the that it was not in that translation.
I've got a note here that says some manuscripts add, for yours is the kingdom of power.
Well, there you go. So evidently there's a textual question that is there. Yes.
Some late
manuscripts have it. Yeah. So there you go. It's there evidently is a manuscript question there.
Ben touched on this over the weekend. He was going through this prayer, and there's themes that he's touching that we address in our prayer.
I was hoping somebody would bring that up and say that, because I almost think we say, oh, that's the Lord's Prayer, right? We're not supposed. That's not a prayer for today. Well, what it is, it's an instructional prayer. And by the way, there's a difference between repetition and meaningless repetition. There would be nothing wrong than reading these words as a prayer to God if they flowed from your heart. We need to be careful about not overreacting to things. But Ben did a great job this weekend. Sorry, ladies, y'all weren't there for this, but it was good. Kind of walking us through the prayer and talking about the categories of things that are here. It's on YouTube if you want to go back and watch it, and how we ought to use them in our prayers. I thought that was really, really good, useful. It's there for that reason. So I'm going to move on unless someone will say something else about the prayer. Okay? Last segment was on fasting, and really the point being made about fasting is exactly the same as he said about giving and he said about prayer, and that is? Yeah, don't do it to impress people. And evidently, they could totally work it out that they looked haggard, that people would say, dude, what's wrong with you? Oh, I'm fasting. Wow. I mean, He had just given up jelly beans. He's doing this serious, really fasting, and people would be impressed. And the same point is, if that's what you're looking for, the praise of men is all you are going to get. I don't think that's where Lisa was going. Lisa was asking, so what about us now and fasting? And we can tap that a little bit. What about us and fasting now? Well, there you go. They have nothing whatsoever to say about that. We don't. Any of y'all ever fasted? Any of y'all ever fasted?
Yes.
Yeah. Some people do it for health reasons, right? It's a intermittent fast.
How long is without food considered fasting?
dude, if I miss a meal, I've been fasting. That's how that is. If lunch is late, that's what. There's actually an intermittent fasting thing where you just don't eat after a certain time of day, and then you give yourself that much of a gap, which is just horrible. And so there are different reasons people do it. I'm kind of where you are about it. It was clearly common back then, even required at certain times in the Old Testament, if I'm right about that. But I think the struggle we have is we don't have demanded times to do it. And regulations to lay that down for everybody. So I think it becomes a matter of personal judgment. I would say that I think it's a healthy exercise. And if you've never done it, should consider it. I remember I was at a church, we were about to appoint elders. It's the first time this church had ever had elders. The preacher said, hey, you know, why don't we all fast about this on Saturday? And I thought it was helpful. I think also the value of learning the discipline over your body in a time where people are not disciplined in the way they handle their body in so many facets, that it would be healthy, a healthy exercise to do. Anybody else want to comment about that? Okay?
David?
Yes, please.
Not about that in particular. Maybe back up just for a moment. I've been thinking about what you were talking about with prayer and over the weekend. And even the comment that Mark made last week regarding his song leading, because he has a great voice, he has great ability to lead singing, and some people think, you know, you're showing off. And you can put that same thing in perspective with people in the offer of prayer. Some people are just more eloquent in speech, and perhaps that's even how they pray in their private prayers. So when they stand up there and pray for a prayer for the congregation, I'm automatically assuming they're doing it from their heart. And I think sometimes we sit back and say, he's just showing off because he can use such eloquent words and word things perfectly and all that kind of stuff. Well, some people just have that ability. Others don't.
That's a great...
So it's not our point should be they're receiving the words that are being spoken, not who's delivering and how they're doing. Same thing with song.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's just going to have a different heart.
Yeah, okay, so let's think about that. That's a good comment. Thank you. Who's being addressed in this segment of chapter 6? Or did that question totally... No, in the prayer segment. Who's being addressed? Well, all of this segment, 1 through 18, who's being addressed?
Disciples.
Disciples who give, and disciples who pray, and disciples who fast. He's speaking to me as an individual in my works of righteousness. I don't think he's saying here, you should watch other people give and judge them. I don't think this is about me. And in fact, who can know this about me? Yeah. Yes. So we don't really have the capacity to know why someone uses the words they do when they pray. Although I think guide, guard, and direct us, we probably know where that's coming from. But I don't even know, that guy may sincerely be never worth it. I don't have the ability to judge that. That kind of gets back to what we said about hypocrite. You need to be very careful about deciding what's underneath people's outside behavior. Sometimes we're telling ourselves a story about that, and we don't really know. How do you know what's in someone's heart?
I just have one more thing.
Hold on one second. Let me get that question. How do we know what's in someone's heart? If they tell you, if you ask and they tell you, then I could know. They could. And then we don't know. That's exactly. This is a dangerous territory. And I mean, sometimes you gotta go there. You gotta talk about that because we need help with our hearts. But the truth is, we don't ever really know except as someone tells us, right? Yeah, I'll let you wrap us up.
No, you tell me.
That it?
Yeah.
See, you were trying to, and I just took it away. I'm sorry about that.
You're better at
the So let's move on, unless anybody has anything else about that segment 1 through 18. Thank you, Lisa, for inviting us back there. We covered some important ground there, I think. So picking up in verse 19, I kind of read back and forth, up and down this over and over again last week. And this seems kind of a bit of an abrupt transition. Do y'all buy that? Because do you, let me ask this question first. Do you agree that it changes subjects at 19?
Not really.
Whoa, so you're going to throw me the curve tonight. I will not call on you the rest of the class. What's that?
He lives for
being a troublemaker? Okay. What are we going to talk about picking up at 19?
What you value, where your heart
is. In reference to what? Because we have been talking about praying and fasting and giving, but now what are we talking about? Stuff. Our stuff. Now, I might get John in here. We may get on the same page. I don't believe the point has changed. Because as y'all correctly identified, what he's going to say about our stuff pertains to our heart, where we are in our heart about our stuff. I think that bigger idea is still working. But it feels like we're moving on to something new. Can I invite you to disagree with that?
No, we are.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
And same for the pastor and same for the prayer, the alms giver. I mean, so I think in that sense, this just wraps that up. They're all thinking about earthly things, not heavenly things.
Well, there you go. There's a nice connection for us. Thank you. I think of all the segments of the sermon, this is among the most familiar to us. In fact, verse 33, seek first his kingdom and his, we have a whole song about that. That may be one of the most quoted verses of the whole sermon. Why do you think that is? Why do we seem drawn to this last part of chapter 6?
I think that it's reassuring that if you put your heart in the right place, that God will take care of the things
that you need. We put our heart in the right place, God will take care of what we need. Thank you. Okay, thank you, John.
On Friday night, we kind of talked about discipleship.
Alf.
And it seems like when you're talking about where your treasure is, there is your heart also. You're all in. You're either all in or you're not. And so discipleship is a commitment that we all really need to think about. Because if you get distracted with everything else that's going on, then you're not all in.
And I think that really is, with regard to our stuff, a point that he is really going to drive home here, especially early. I think there are two segments to this last piece. I think that he talks about our stuff all the way from verse 19 to the end of the chapter, but I think he's got one angle in verses 19 through 24 and then a different from 25 on, and we'll look at those two pieces in just a minute, but I would agree with the sentiment that a couple of you have expressed, that this is a struggle. Though I want to add that I think the nature of our struggle is profoundly different than the struggle for the people who read this, right?
Absolutely.
So recognize that those people could literally starve to death. So you would have to work hard to starve to death in America. First of all, if you want to eat, you can eat. Okay? You can eat every single day. And if you need clothes to wear, you can get clothes. You have to have money to do either of those things. And I didn't say that you get to pick your clothes, but you can eat, you can wear clothes, you can find shelter in America today if you never earned a dime, right? For those people, there was no system to protect them for that. So people in the world at that time literally did starve to death. And so that's the angle from which they read the words, take no thought for your food. Don't take it out of your body, what you're going to clothe it with, what you're going to eat. I think they read that differently than you and I would. And so let that tension play out and the difference in the way that we see it. I do think that this registers with us, though, because we are concerned about our stuff. We have a lot of stuff. I mean, we poor mouth. I know, but we have a lot of stuff, and we want more, and we really, really fear losing it. And so I think he's gonna challenge us a bit here as we go through this segment. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, yeah. And for us, again, it isn't about having clothes to take with us. We don't have to worry about that. And yet still we do. So let's work this segment a little bit. I want to start with 19 through 24. I just want to ask you to read this with me, and then I'm going to ask you when we get done, what do you hear? And we'll kick that around a little bit, and then we'll do the same thing with 25. There's no clock on the wall, so I'm watching my watch. That doesn't mean I want you to stop talking if you're making a comment, okay? I'm probably grab that moment to keep up with my time so we cover these two segments. So 19 says, do not store up for yourself treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break it and steal. Store up for yourself treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy, and where thieves do not break and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. There's our inside. The eye is the lamp of the body, so if your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light, but if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No man could serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. So tell me what you hear there. As he talks to us about our stuff. Why do you think he says that to us in 19 and 20? Why do you think he says to us, physical stuff you collect is not going to last? Put our trust in him.
That's not the real important things.
Sorry?
That's not the real important thing that we need to look forward to.
So when it comes to where we set our hearts, I think he wants us to recognize the futility, right? And we all learned that as little children with Christmas presents. How many of you broke them in January, right? Or by the next Christmas couldn't find what you got, that treasured gift under the tree, and like by the fall of next year, where's that thing?
Or on Christmas Day, you played with the box more than you
did. Oh, yeah. There were some messed up kids that did that, that's true. Yeah. So I think his point in 19 to 20 is the futility of making this your focus, because, you know, this stuff doesn't last, right? And whatever you get tired of it. And even when you get a lot, you get bored with it and you're looking for something new. And does it sound like I'm preaching Jeff's sermon from this morning? Because I'm listening to him preach and I'm thinking, stop it. I got to have something to teach in class tonight. Because it is the same kind of point. What else do you hear in this segment besides that?
Look at it clearly, you know.
Yeah, the eye stuff is kind of weird, isn't it? I think you read 22 and 23 and you think, wait, I thought we were talking about heart, and now he's talking about eyes, and I think it's a figure for the heart. And I think what he's saying there is how really important it is to get this right, because if you get it right, if this is right on the inside, and the figure is, if your eye is clear, you'll be enlightened. You'll see the way you ought to go. You'll walk in the light, right? But what if it isn't? Yes. Yeah, if your eye isn't clear and it's corrupted and your vision, your spiritual vision is blurred, then it becomes more difficult. Then we struggle, right? And how many times have we had the struggle? Maybe guys who've been in a position where the boss is saying, hey, it's really a great promotion. It'll be lots of money. You're going to be traveling about 200 days a year. And what are you thinking? Money, family, promotion. Yeah. What do I see? The struggle sometimes is because this isn't where it ought to be. My focus isn't in the right place. And so I think that's what you're trying to tell us there. That's really, really important. So back up to 21, where he tells us what it would be, what it ought to be. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So now we get that inside piece introduced in this part of the sermon. What we go after, what we pursue, he says, exposes what it is we really treasure, where our heart is set. And so we can look out here at our lives and say, what am I going after? And I'm thinking that, guys, where look at your calendar. Do y'all keep one of those? I like keep 12. And to-do lists. And someone say, that's not fair. You're a preacher. I know, it's the greatest job on earth, right? And where my resources go, my energies, what do I think about all the time? Where is it? And he said, if you'll identify what that is, you'll know where your heart is. And see, I think that's where this is really hard, because now I'm getting down on the inside. What is really there? What is it that I really value, really important to me? And if I value the wrong things, he says, everything's going to be messed up. You're not going to go. And I think our struggles are sometimes identifying that, right? Because I don't really know what it is that I value most. Okay, what else do you see here? Hey, man, yeah, sacred selections. I'm going to help get the children adopted.
It hooks you, and you go, okay, it's a good thing, and you're not seeing clearly, and so your focus is off.
Right, right. Thank you. What else do you see? Yes, Rick. Men's praise. You and John are determined to help me connect that all together. I am very grateful. Thank you.
David,
yes?
One of the struggles I've always had in my life as a man taking care of my family is the whole balance issue. Because I've talked to my son about this a lot. He's got two young children, and he's trying to work on a career path and the amount of time it takes. Because I've constantly been trying to track my time, where do I spend my time, and how much time I spend on all these things of taking care of your possessions, taking care of your home, all that kind of stuff, and then comparing that to the time I spend in God's Word or focusing on the spiritual matters of life. And it's a tough balance to strike. And sometimes I'm rather hard on myself about that, saying, you know, don't be spending your time here, spending your time there. But yet, you know, when pipes start breaking and things of that nature, you've got to go take care of that.
Right.
Your influence is lost. What did I do? Why did I spend my time? I said,
I think this is not an absolute, but I'm much happier about people who say I wrestle and struggle. You know, like someone who says I wrestle with knowing if I'm studying enough, or I'm wrestling to know if I'm putting too much of a priority on my work and not enough on my family. I'm worried about the guy that doesn't wrestle, right? You see, sometimes the wrestling is I want to pursue the right thing, and I got to be sure that's straight in my heart. I want to comment on verse 24. We didn't comment on that. Why do you think he says we can't serve two masters? Yeah. Thank you. What else? Why does he tell us that?
Because he doesn't want half
of us. But we think we can do the half part, right? And the problem is that both the pursuit of stuff and the pursuit of the Lord and the kingdom and his righteousness, they both demand or seek to master us. They demand our time and our energy and our resources. And you can't be devoted to both, right? I'm not saying you can't do both, because obviously you have to. You got to work a job and raise your kids and keep a house, however you divide all those things. That somebody's got to fix the pipes, right? And mow the grass, or the neighbor, the HOA is going to be in your back, right? So those things have to be done. It's not about, do I have the task to be done? It is what has mastered me, the kingdom or this world? Yeah.
One version says adoration of one feeds contempt for the other.
Adoration of one feeds contempt for the other. I like that. Yeah. So bear in mind here, and in fact, let me just throw this question out. Some people hear this kind of stuff and they say, well, I guess you mean that the disciples just shouldn't care about any physical stuff. In fact, I preached about materialism one time, and one of the elder's wives came out and said, thanks a lot. I have been working on my husband for 6 months for a new couch, and finally he agreed yesterday that we could get one, and now he's going to totally use this lesson all the way home. So my question is, does this mean we can't have stuff? I think that's right.
Your priorities are who I'm serving.
Yeah.
Is that still the same conversation he's having here?
Yeah. It's unbiblical to say we can't have stuff. In fact, God gave people stuff.
And he talked a lot about connecting blessings, you know, as
yes,
something that he provides.
Right.
Enjoy the fruit, you know, Abraham was wealthy. Job was wealthy.
Right. By the way, remember that everybody is rich to somebody. You ever thought about that? The guy who's living on the street has someone who is saying, I wish I had a grocery cart to roll my stuff around in like he does, right? To everybody, there's somebody else who's rich. I don't think this has anything to do with how much you have at all. It's not what it's about. It's not about wanting more. If you're living in a one-bedroom apartment and you're having your second baby and you're thinking, be nice to have some more bedrooms, is that sinful to want more or bigger? Listen, at my stage of life, it's about adding to that retirement nest egg. You know, I want to be okay. I think that kind of prudence is encouraged in Scripture. I don't think that's wrong to be concerned about things. I think about Luke 12, right? The parable. After the two brothers come to Jesus fighting about who's going to get the inheritance, right? And Jesus tells them a parable of the guy whose crops are so great. Was it wrong that his crops were great? Who sent the rain on those crops, right? And so he has this farm that's too small. And so he builds bigger barns. Was there anything wrong with building bigger barns? Was God unhappy because he built bigger barns? And he did so well, he had time to retire early. He had leisure time. Is there anything wrong with leisure time? See, we miss that. He tells us what the problem is, and it's not with what he had, right? What was the problem with the rich farmer? Remember?
I've done this. I mean, it's a focus on himself, not a focus on...
I thought about that. I was thinking about verse 21.
I thought he was in control.
He was not what? Rich toward God, which would wrap in a lot of the stuff you guys are saying. But my point is, God's condemnation of him is based on what he didn't have. It wasn't about what he did have. Yeah.
But that's, taking Robert's example of working to take care of your family, yes, that's one way to take care of your family, but unfortunately many men think that's the only way to take care of your family, when in reality, you're being home and you're directing the family is much more important than providing the new car or the nicer house in the nicer neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean, and if all you think about is, I'm working and I'm doing... Yes, you've got to work. God wants you to work. But how are you really taking care of your family?
Yeah. Yeah. If I could offer an example that might work in illustrating this for you guys. I had a good friend back in Chicago. This is the class of Chicago examples. Mark Childers. And he had started worshiping with us. He was really eager to get involved in Bible class. Felt like he had some things to share. Problem was, he was one of these shift workers that the shift changed all the time. So this week he might be available there for every service, and then for 2 weeks he may not be able to be there at all. And I said, that's not going to be helpful in a Bible class. We can't use you with that shift. And that really bothered him. He really wanted to be involved in the class. And so he called me a couple of weeks later and he said, hey, you can sign me up. I'll be there every class. I said, what gives? He said, a job posted on the line in the factory, and he says it's a demotion and I'm going to make a little less money, but it's 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, and I can be more involved in what's happening with Bible class. And so in my mind, this is a guy whose heart is the kingdom is what matters to me, and my job is getting in the way of that. But there's an option here. It's less money, but still enough for me to live on. It's not a promotion, it's a demotion, to which his coworkers thought, what? You're crazy. But you see, it's the heart longing to do what the kingdom wants. I'm not asking everybody to go get a demotion, right? That's not my point. It's not about that. It's about the heart. It's about what's on inside, what matters to me. Does that make sense? So in this second segment, picking up at verse 25, I think what he does here is he gives us maybe one of the best indicators of a heart that's set on the wrong thing. Do you see it? Because it's a word he uses, I don't know, 5 times from 25 to 34, like every other verse. Yes. Do you see it? 25. I say to you, do not be worried about your life. And again, 27. And who of you by being worried can add a single hour to his life? And then 28. Why are you worried about clothing? 31. Do not worry. And again, 34. So do not worry. Over and over again, he talks about anxiety. And I think he goes here because it is an indicator of the problem he's just been trying to help us with in 19 through 24. Our anxiety results from having our hearts set on this world rather than on God. So let's talk a little bit about anxiety. We got about 10 minutes to go through this. Tell me, first of all, what does he mean when he talks about worry? Because we use that word all the time. When I walked in here, I wore short sleeves and I was worried because it was freezing cold when I came in here at 4:30 this afternoon, and I was worried about that. So is that what did I sin? It says, do not worry. Do not worry, huh? I do have pretty high stress levels about stuff. You're right about that. It's speaking to me, John. It's working on me. So what is he talking about? Let me ask you a couple questions that might help with that. Does this mean that I should not be concerned about earning a living and making money and buying stuff.
It goes with the last section. It's about, you know, being too focused on that one thing, and where that's all you care about. That's where your worry, your anxiety, your priority, your all your effort is focused in that one thing. And he's contrasting that with having faith.
Go. Hold that one. Hold on. I want you to help me on that one. I'm get there. Hang on a second. You know, Proverb tells us to be prudent, right? It says, hey, watch out for your herds, you know, because you're gonna need that later on. I mean, we don't have herds, but we have savings. Yeah, that's exactly right. And the admonition there is take care of it, right? So that you can take care of yourself later on. That's biblical. I think the parable of the sower helps us to understand what he's talking about here in this last segment. Remember the third soil? What was it?
Thorny.
It was a thorny soil that symbolized the cares and concerns and the desire. Mark's translation says the desire for riches. And what does it do to us?
Chokes out the word.
So that we are, what does he say? Do you remember?
Unfruitful.
The plant doesn't die. It's just distracted, right? You see the point? And so go back to that idea about what's going to master us. And in that case, we're being mastered by our concern for this world, so much so that spiritually we're being choked. I can't become the person that he wants me to be. So if that's what it is, by the way, there's a worldview piece that's underneath all of this, and I don't want you to miss that. I think that's really important. So that's why I stopped you, because that's where I was heading. So you can finish if you want to. It's really about what? Yeah. Look at verse 30 when he's talking about, look, God takes care of the grass, which is going to get burned up tomorrow. And the point there being,
the grass is kind of useless, but he cares about you.
I'm important. Grass is not. I am. And then he adds, you of little faith. So the real question underneath all of this is, do I believe there's a God who loves and cares about me, who will honor his promise to take care of me, right? That's the real issue that's underneath all of this. Because if I do, I don't have to be consumed with here and now and stuff and all of that. I can set my heart fully on him because I know he's going to take care of me, right? So what does he say through this last segment to help us with our worry? I think there's a whole series of points that he made designed to alleviate that. So there is this lesser to greater argument, right? Look at the birds. What do you say about the birds?
They don't plant food. They don't harvest food. They just have food for
God. God takes care of the birds, right? And look at the grass that we talked about, the point we were making a minute ago. And how I think when I think grass, I think St. Augustine, and I don't think that's what he means here. Look at the things growing in nature, right? God clothes nature with beauty. And if he takes care of these things, you know, a sparrow that falls to the ground and die tomorrow, how much more? It's a lesser to the greater. I am so much more important than that. Yes?
But at the same time, you talk about people during this time who are dying from starving, too. So it's like you hear prosperity preachers talk about, listen, you'll have money. But it's the same thing, right? It's like, well, I'm seeing so-and-so die because they didn't have food even for it. So that's where the worry comes from. It was easier for them to worry about that.
Go ahead.
No, it's okay.
I think we hear this with different ears. Or that's not the right way to say that. I think they heard this with different ears. Because the possibility of not having some place to shelter yourself or clothes to put on your back or food to eat was real for them. And so when he says, of you need a little faith, it's seriously trusting God when dying of hunger is a real possibility, right? Yes. And that's verse 33, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Understand, that's not the point that's being made here. He's not saying you shouldn't be concerned about a retirement nest egg or you should never want a house that has a couple of extra bedrooms. What is he saying? He's saying in the middle of all of that, your focus needs to be on my kingdom and being right with me. That needs to be the thing that masters you. And then he says, trust me for the rest. I'll take care of you. In fact, we didn't get to get through all of this, but he goes on to say, verse 25, for example, listen, there's a whole bunch more important stuff in life than what you wear and what you eat. And I love 27. I wish we could sermonize on 27 for a long time. He's like, okay, so tell me, if you worry, can you be an inch taller or live a day longer?
Actually, it does the opposite.
That's, and so it made me wonder, how many things do we worry and fret over that are things beyond our control? I want you to think about that. The vast majority of things that we just fret over are the things that we can't do anything about anyway. Like tomorrow, right? I don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. I have been working to try to prepare myself for that time when nobody will pay me to do this anymore and, you know, I'm forced to retire and I got to live on the nest egg. But the truth is, I warned you, I'm going to sound a little like Jeff, right? But the whole thing could collapse before then. And we could all be living in tents under the overpass, right? I guess you wouldn't need the tent if it was under the overpass, but it was off the cuff, right? So, and then I love verse 32. What does he tell us there? Already knows. He knows what you need. So if you really wanted to highlight an idea, I would think about that statement at the end of verse 30. Do I really trust him? I really believe God will honor his promise and he'll take care of me. Because then when I do, I can just devote myself fully to him and know that the other things in life are going to be taken care of. He's going to get me through. Okay? For next Sunday, pick up at chapter 7 and verse 1, maybe the most famous section in modern culture, judge not that you be not judged. And we will work down to verse 12 next Sunday, and then that will set us up for the closing segment, 13 through 29. So 1 through 12 of chapter 7 for next week. Good to see you, man. Doing all right?
See you good.